Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at CedarPoint.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And it's Saturday. Time to venture into the vault for a classic episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind. This one originally aired November 13th, 2018. This was our interview with the Emory professor, Dietrich Stout, about Stone Age technology.
Yeah, this one was a lot of fun. We actually had him in the studio, so no phone call static or anything going on with this one. He was tremendously interesting to chat with, and even engage some discussion on 2001: A Space Odyssey, which of course was the vault in, episode that we aired before this one.
Yeah, so we hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we have for you an interview episode, an episode where we sat down and talked to an expert on Paleolithic technology. And I'm really excited for y'all to hear this one because this conversation was a lot of fun. Stone Age technology is so much more fascinating than you would think.
Yeah, because in looking at it, we're looking really at the roots of human invention and innovation. Like, where does the entire tree of human technology spring from?
Yeah, and how did ancient technology shape us? So this is going to be a conversation with Dr. Dietrich Stout. Dietrich Stout is an associate professor of anthropology at Emory University, where his Paleolithic Technology Laboratory investigates the role of technology in human evolution. Dr. Stout is also Associate Director of Emory's Cross-Disciplinary Center for Mind, Brain, and Culture, which promotes diverse and integrative research into human nature and experience. His research focus on Paleolithic stone tool making and brain evolution integrates field research at early Stone Age archaeological sites in Ethiopia with laboratory and museum research, including artifact analysis and experimental replication, functional and structural neuroimaging, behavioral analysis, and psychometric testing. Now, if you want to check out those centers I mentioned, the Paleolithic Technology Laboratory, you can find that at scholarblogs.emory.edu/stoutlab. And then the Center for Mind, Brain, and Culture, you can just go to cmbc.emory.edu.
Yeah, this is a super fun interview. I should stress that this was an in-studio interview.
Yeah.
One of a couple of interviews we recorded about a month ago where we said, hey, let's reach out to some local experts on some various topics. We don't necessarily – we enjoyed jumping on the phone with folks, but why not have some local talent come into the studio? And that's what we did here.
It was a lot of fun, and I think you will really enjoy it. So I'd say without any further ado, let's go straight to our conversation with Dietrich Stout. Hey, Dietrich, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. Can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, well, I'm an associate professor of anthropology at Emory University. I'm also the associate director of the Center for Mind, Brain, and Culture at Emory as well, which is a center that promotes interdisciplinary research on mind, brain, and culture. And those are basically my interests. I come at it from the direction of archaeology in the hope that we can learn something from the past about what made us the way we are today.
So how did you first get interested in Stone Age technology?
Well, it's not something that you typically encounter in most high schools around the country. So, you know, when I went to college, I really had no idea of the possibilities that were there for anthropology, for the archaeology of human origins. I did know that I was interested in the way the human mind works and the nature of human experience. And at the time, I thought that meant that I wanted to be a philosopher. When I got to school, I realized what I said before, that a lot of the way we can understand how we are today and the nature of human experience is to understand the evolutionary processes that brought us to where we are. And I had a really great professor as a freshman in a freshman seminar. He told me to take some archaeology classes. I did. And I just remember one lecture that my professor gave in which he was talking about these ancient stone tools and a particular kind called the Levallois technique. And he was pointing out that you could see every individual action and blow against the core that this person had done something like 50 or 100,000 years ago. And you could reconstruct what they were thinking, the plans that they made. And that just struck me as an incredible window on the past and how our minds became the way that they are today. And that's what got me started on it.
Yeah, like seeing into a dead person's imagination.
Yeah, to be able to capture that. I mean, and now I've worked at sites that are 500,000 years old where you can literally trace individual decision-making processes. It's pretty incredible. I actually held a core at one of these sites. I was looking at it, and I was wondering why they didn't do something that I would have done with that core, that piece of rock. And I twisted it around to look at where I was thinking about it, and I saw that they actually had tried what I was thinking, but it didn't work. So both of us made the same mistake, separated by 500,000 years.
Oh, that's almost a little spooky.
Yeah.
So obviously we know that the Stone Age means stone tools. But what, as an expert in the area, what does the Stone Age mean to you? What do you think about when this age is conjured?
Yeah, well, I think really of the time period for which we have evidence of human behavior in the forms of archaeology, but extending way back into the past so that we have information, but it's also an evolutionary time depth. You know, we're talking millions of years, more than 3 million years at this point of time. So that's what gets me excited about the Stone Age. And of course, you know, it's called the Stone Age for a reason. Most of what we have, or the best evidence, is the stone tools for behavior. So that's what I've focused on.
And when you think about the very beginning of the Paleolithic, obviously we're talking about hominid ancestors then, but not Homo sapiens, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so when those organisms were alive, when they were trying to survive and stone tools began to play a role in their lives, what was that role? What was the earliest role you think stone tools played in these organisms' survival?
Yeah, well, I should say at the outset, there's a lot of things we don't really know with any great certainty about the earliest Paleolithic. I think that there is strong evidence that some of the earlier tools were used for butchery of animals, because you can recover actual cut marks on bones when somebody accidentally nicked a bone as they were butchering an animal. And so that's a direct evidence. Now, what else they were used for is much harder to say, because the plant materials, all those things are gone. So there's very limited evidence of that. And it's only in the past couple of years that it's been reported a much earlier site. We used to think the earliest stone tools were 2.5 million years old. I've worked at some of those sites. But now they go back to 3.3 million years. And we, as yet, have very little evidence of what they might have done with those tools. Hopefully, in the next few years, there'll be the kinds of evidence that I was talking about. But it's just not there yet. So a lot of unknowns. If I had to say, these things are cutting tools. And the most important thing probably for early humans to be able to cut was animal flesh to access that. But they could have used them for a lot of other things, including making other tools. One of the great things about having a cutting edge is your ability to shape other tools, for instance, in wood. If you have a knife in the form of a stone flake, you can make a spear. You can make a digging stick. Again, though, the wood's not there anymore. So if they did that, we have a hard time knowing for sure.
And when you mentioned those dates a minute ago, that's referring to is that modified stone tools? We're not talking about like found stone tools.
No. And in fact, it would be nearly impossible to identify and differentiate a found stone tool from a rock.
Right.
yeah, at this point. So that's all right. We know chimpanzees use rocks as tools.
Right.
So it's, you know, likely that our very early ancestors did. By 3.3, we have evidence of them actually fracturing rock on purpose in a controlled way to produce cutting edges. And that's something that we can definitively separate from a natural process. So we know it occurred at that point.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but are there broad stroke classifications for the different levels of tool creation? Like, I want to say it's something like nature fact, artifact, et cetera. Could you walk our listeners through that?
Yeah, well, you know, of course you could have unmodified rocks used as tools, for instance, to crack open a nut as chimpanzees and some monkeys, macaque monkeys do that as well. And that's a tool, you know, and it's a stone tool. Mm-hmm. What we see by 3.3 million years is the actual modification of the rock on purpose in order to make a different kind of tool. That's generally a process simply of fracturing the rock to produce sharp shards or flakes of stone that then become knives. So that's loosely called like mode one. The most well-known industry that does that is the Olduvai, named after Olduvai Gorge, where Mary and Lewis Leakey worked. And that's a very simple form of stone tool making. It does require quite a bit of coordination. It's not easy to break rocks. They're hard. Mm-hmm. You have to hit them just right and with a lot of force. But it's pretty conceptually simple. You know, you're not going to really make flakes. And then after that, you've got what variously is called like mode two, or loosely called Acheulean, after a site where it was first described in Europe. It's the manufacturer of these things that archaeologists call hand axes. And that's where you're not just shattering the rock into flakes, but you're actually shaping the rock to make a tool. The classic tool from this sort of stage or time period is the hand axe, which would be a flat rock with a cutting edge most of the way around the perimeter and a tip at one end. Can be good, again, we think, for large animal butchery. And so that's where you've moved then to actually having the intention, having a goal in mind, and the techniques that you, the control over the stone that's required is more. Following that, you have what we call prepared core technologies, in which you shape the rock in a careful way so that you can remove one final piece that's already pre-shaped the way you want it to be. And then you can do that over and over again, so it becomes a very efficient way of making tools. And then there's all sorts of variations on that. And that's the point in which we think there's a big change, that they start actually putting these things on sticks, for instance, and hafting, okay. Right? So we have composite tools, and you have all sorts of other techniques and materials that then enter the process, and things become much more complex. Yeah.
So you mentioned the hand axe. I'm interested to know a little bit more about that. I may be mistaken, but there have been identified, I think, different schools of hand axe construction. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are different ways of making something that we call a hand axe. Mm-hmm. Now, we also, I would be very careful about that. We should always remember that when we call something a hand axe, that's a name that we came up with to describe right. a bunch of things that we think are all similar to each other. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily map onto what anybody was thinking in the past or whether they knew each other or whatever. So it's a tool, but we have to be careful about it. You put a name on something, you think you understand it. As I mentioned, a hand axe has a particular form. There's a lot of different ways you could achieve that and a lot of different starting points. For instance, I might start with just a big rock and then shape that rock into a pointed, thin hand axe. Or I could start with an even larger rock and then I knock off a giant flake, more than 10 centimeters long is generally the cutoff. And that's almost already what I need. It's got a big cutting edge all the way around the edge, and then I shape that flake just a little bit, right? And that's a very different way of making a tool that in the end probably has a similar function and looks quite similar. And then there's all sorts of different sub-variants of ways of doing that. So that's what I think when you're talking about different schools is these different methods of making the hand axes. Now, there's a raging debate over what the variation actually means. The sort of naive assumption early on was every time you find a different way of doing something, that's a different, quote, culture, even though we don't really know what we mean by that term at that point. Now there's people saying that, these are just recurring rediscoveries of simple solutions to the same kind of problems. They don't necessarily imply any sort of cultural continuity or contact between people. There's even been suggestions that there was some kind of large genetic component to the way that people made these hand axes. So now it's up for debate, but the variation is what we study to try to understand what was going on in the past. That's where we have a sort of an insight into what was happening.
Well, I was definitely going to ask you the naive question about whether that's a result of culture, but is there – so if we don't make that assumption that the different forms or shapes or approaches to hand axes are necessarily the result of cultural traditions or cultural contact, is there anything – that you think looking at tools like this, Stone Age tools, could possibly tell us about the culture of the creatures that made them?
Yeah, well, and so this is where we have to get into the sort of stuff that you can learn through experimental archaeology. For instance, how difficult is it to discover and use particular techniques? If there's two people that do something the same way, if it's an obvious answer, then there's no reason to think they learned it from each other. But if it's this really sort of obscure and hard to learn technique that they share, then it's much more likely that they learned it from each other. So there's this thing in the Acheulean, geographic patterning to where you have far fewer hand axes in East Asia than you do in Africa and Western Asia and Europe. And also, none of them really appear to be as refined as some of the nicest examples from further west. And so people have debated for a long time what this geographical patterning means. And I tend to interpret it, as in terms of there are some techniques that are pretty hard to discover on your own and some that are easy, And so you have a lot of reinvention of sort of easy hand axe making here, there, and the other place, but these particular advanced techniques may only have been invited once or twice or a couple times, and so their geographic spread was more restricted. So that's sort of the way that you make a relationship between understanding the way that you actually make the tools and then how they might spread through ancient populations.
So you mentioned experimental archaeology. Yeah. I know a lot of people probably, when they think about the data collection part of archaeology, they probably think primarily about digging. But tell us a little bit about what experimental archaeology means and what kind of things it has helped us understand that we couldn't understand just from looking at actual artifacts.
Yeah, well, what you can understand from just looking at the artifact is actually a bit limited. These things, they don't come out of the ground with labels on them. I like to do this when I give a presentation, I show a picture of a table full of a bunch of old one stone tools and say, like, okay, now what does this tell us? and in most people, you know, you can't even tell that they're anything other than just rocks if you're not used to looking at them. So what we have to do to understand what these tools that we dig up can actually tell us is basically experimental archaeology. We use analogies. We try to learn how to make them ourselves, and then you can manipulate, well, if I make it this way, then it looks like that. If I make it this way, it looks like that. If I use it this way, this happens to it. So then we make these analogies, these sort of inferential arguments that processes that we can observe and manipulate experimentally now are the same ones that produce the same effects in the past. If you think about it, we do this anytime, even in more recent time periods, when you look at an artifact, I mean, you're making an analogy with something you're familiar with usually. Even if it's just implicit, you know, oh, obviously this is a sword. You know, I've seen things like that before. Now, you don't really know that you're right, but it's similar enough to things with which you're familiar that's, you know, that's reasonable. When you dig up something from 2.5 million years ago, you've got nothing to go on, right? So we have to actually do some of this work to establish robust or strong analogies that we can use.
Now, you've mentioned your own experiences creating stone tools. How long does it take you to create a hand axe?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it takes me maybe half an hour. I'm a little bit slow with that. Depending on how nice you want to make it. And that's already assuming that I'm sitting in my outdoor lab with a pile of rocks right next to me, and I just start making the thing, you know. In prehistory, you would have had to go get the rocks, and all these other things take a lot more time. But yeah, somebody that's quite good at it in 12 to 15 minutes.
So you mentioned that we think a lot of these early stone tools were used in butchering meat. Have you ever had food prepared with stone tools you've made?
Well, let's see. Myself, only actually recently one of my colleagues had a pig roast where we used some of the stuff that I had made. But back in graduate school, I mean, it's quite common in these labs and places where people do this sort of work to have the occasional animal roast where you use it. And you learn things like, you know, that obsidian is really sharp and great, but it also crumbles and leaves little bits of like glassy kind of crunchy stuff. Yeah, it's, you know, not so great. I like flint.
Right. Better. So do we find little grains of obsidian in ancient teeth?
I'm not aware. I'm not well versed in later prehistory, and so there's a possibility there's something out there about that. I'm not aware of them actually getting any dental wear from the stone tools. Of course, you get very similar looking dental wear when you eat tubers you dug out of sandy ground. So it'd be hard. You do get cut marks on teeth, which is very interesting because way commonly to eat things if you don't use silverware or chopsticks or anything like that is you hold it up to your mouth, you clench it in your teeth, and you cut away from there. So you're cutting right next to your mouth, and occasionally they did hit their teeth. And so you get these little cut marks on the front teeth.
That's
fascinatingly
gross.
Sorry. Yeah, a lot of things we do are gross. But one of the cool things, you can actually infer which hand was used because there's it's sort of an ergonomics to your slicing down and in one direction, so you can tell. And so people have used that to identify early examples of predominantly right-handed populations. See, even the gross stuff, there's always something you can get out of it.
Oh, no, we encourage you to mention all the gross stuff. We don't shy away from that here. Yeah.
So how is the study of modern stone tool users, stone tool users in New Guinea, how has this informed our understanding of ancient stone tool use?
Basically, the whole goal of experimental archaeology is to generate analogies that we can observe in the modern day to understand the past. One of the things we have to be careful about, though, is that when you design experiments and you control things, you build in a lot of your own assumptions, even if you're not aware of them, about how things are done or why things are done and so forth. You're also dealing with a very artificial environment in the lab without any social context or anything like that. So another source of analogy that you can use to understand the past is ethnographic observation. And by that, I would stress you can include also people, for instance, in the United States that do this as a hobby. There's a community. there are things we can learn from them. I was lucky enough to visit some modern tool makers in New Guinea that are part of a different tradition. Back in 1999, I was there. And one of the things that, that just broadens the number of different examples of ways to do things that we can use to understand the past. And one of the really cool things about it was I was expecting this to be a very very foreign experience to be in the highlands of New Guinea. But once we got to the stone tools, they talked about a lot of the same things that I, as an archaeologist, was already used for. They had names for the same kinds of features of the stone tools, mm-hmm. So there was a real common ground there because we were all based on things that happen when you try to break stone in a controlled way. And that's very validating for an archaeologist because it means we can expect that even moving then to the total unknown of the past, there's going to be these constants that shaped human behavior. And if we can understand them today, it looks like they affect different people from very different cultural backgrounds in similar ways. And so that's very validating. The other thing that was really exciting there is just how they incorporated stone tool making into their own particular cultural and social context, which obviously if you study hobbyists in the industrialized West is one context, but this was a horticultural context in the way they had a sort of a system of apprenticeship for learning this. And the amount of time that it takes to become an expert in they had a particularly advanced kind of tool making. But the sheer effort and the social values they attached to sticking with it and practicing, the support they provided for learning that way, I found that to be all very inspirational for my own research.
So in dealing with the stone toolmakers in New Guinea, I'm assuming there was a language barrier there.
Yes, a translator.
How did that reveal anything or back up anything that you any pre-existing thoughts about the effects of tool use and tool making on language and the origins of language?
Yeah, well, I think it was there's been an idea for some time, which we're increasingly articulating, that one of the things that may have led to the evolution of language in terms of an evolutionary pressure or favoring language evolution is the need to be able to teach each other, and particularly the ability to teach people that you're related to, because then you get sort of the genetic benefit and all that mm-hmm. kind of thing. And in New Guinea, it was really striking the amount of social support in various ways that was provided for people learning. I found that very informative. So, of course, language, talking actually, do this, don't do that, or we call this, also, the use of language to tell stories, which establishes, sort of these cultural norms. They tell a story about someone who is a great toolmaker because he spent all of his time practicing and he neglected his fields and didn't talk to his wife, and all this sort of stuff. And that the socializing that they do, they sit together and it makes it fun. All of these things are really important to learning something that's very frustrating and difficult. Maybe you can think of analogies in your own experience. And so that was really, really cool. And then just the also all of the gesturing, the pointing, and just the context of having particular places where you do things. This is where we go to get the rocks. This is where we all sit down and make tools together. There was a structure. So there was so much about what they were doing socially that resulted in the sustaining of this technology. And I thought – obviously you can't just project that into a particular past context, but we need to expand our thinking broadly to think about these other dimensions that may be implied by some of the ancient stone tools that we find.
Okay, time to take a quick break, but we will be right back with more of our conversation.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first of its kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, we're back. Let's jump back in.
Now, obviously, this is a different question from how the crafting of stone tools might have changed our neuroanatomy over time. But I wonder, does making stone tools just change the way you in your life think about your relationship with the earth? Like, do you find yourself out walking and looking down and saying, oh, there's a good one? No, that's not a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, particularly if you've been doing a lot recently, you can't see a rock without picturing it breaking, you know. and of course, just doing, being an archaeologist does that too. I'm always looking at little pebbles, and my wife will catch me looking at the landscaping, you know, and like, oh, that would be a good hammer stone or something like that, you know. So, it does influence some of the resources that you're aware of that are really not particularly relevant for most people in their daily lives, but were once incredibly central.
Well, I think about ways that that type of thinking can take on more complex kind of mental dimensions. Like, I think about the way when I go shopping, if I'm like picking out produce to cook with, I can see like a good fresh piece of produce and I attribute moral goodness to that. and I see like a bad, rotten piece of produce, and I attribute moral badness to it. Do you ever feel inklings of that kind of thing with rocks?
Oh, well, there's certainly I don't know about the moral dimension so much, but there's certainly a real aesthetic to it. I mean, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Flint, but it's a beautiful rock, and the sound that it makes and the way that it breaks when it does what you want it to is just infinitely pleasing. I just got some really nice basalt as well, which is a very different kind of rock and has different, but also really just aesthetically pleasing, and you get a real pleasure out of working it. Yeah.
So you said you can hear the difference between a good break and a bad break.
Yeah. This is a question. I mean, I think it's important, and I've talked to people who are much more experienced stone toolmakers than I am that really emphasize that, you know, the sound is important. And in fact, we're just in the process of developing an online test that people can take where we play the sounds of a stone flake coming off, and you use a little slider to say how big you think it was. So we're trying to see how much information is actually present in those sounds. I know that when we're sitting around napping, everybody's looking, napping being a term we used to talk about stone tool making, not to be confused with falling asleep, but
it's knocking the flakes off.
Napping. I don't know if it's German or something. We don't even know where it comes from, but yeah, knocking the flakes off. Anyway, we're sitting around knocking the flakes off and, you know, all staring down at what we're doing. And then somebody will strike off a really nice large flake, and it makes this flat popping sound, and everybody just looks up over at them and says, wow, all right. You know? So anyway, long story, we think the sound is probably really important, and we're trying to probe that. It keeps coming up also in some of the neuroimaging research that we do, where we look at stone tool making, and we get these activity in areas that are more classically auditory, and initially wasn't expecting that, but of course it makes sense.
That is interesting. And the stuff about the tool making process giving you all these sort of aesthetic values when you look at rocks or when you hear the sounds rocks make, does that lead you to draw any connections between the origins of tool crafting and the origins of art?
Yeah, sure. You know, in a informal of way, and you know, people have written about these ideas, and this is another area sort of contention, particularly with the hand axes. They're beautiful, right? They're very appealing. And there's some argument that, in fact, they are much too beautiful and appealing for no apparent functional benefit, that this must be one of our earliest examples of, you know, aesthetic sense. But as I mentioned, it's awfully hard to demonstrate that in a really compelling way to skeptics. It is hard to say. You do get these glimmerings of interesting things like, you know, they make a hand axe and there'll be a fossil impression of a shell that they leave right in the middle of the center of one of the sides. You know, it's sort of like they showed it off. Or was that an accident? It is hard to say. But certainly from our perspective, the symmetry and many of the aspects of these tools are very aesthetically pleasing. So we'd like to speculate that there's some relationship there.
Is there any indication with any particular hand axes that are particularly beautiful to modern eyes that they were in any way merely ritualistic? That they were not used?
So it's a bit hard because it's actually not always possible to show that many of the hand axes were used. You need particular preservation conditions and evidence to actually demonstrate that something was used, so we rarely get that. On the other hand, there are examples of things that look like they couldn't have been used. These are very rare, but there's be like this really giant hand axe, like the length of my forearm, you know, that somebody made. And in our imagination, it's pretty hard to come up with a functional reason to do that. So it seems to have been somebody showing off or just trying to produce a piece that is somehow appealing to them or something like that. It's elusive. There are these glimmerings of it.
So we've already mentioned a little bit the possible relationships between tool use and the development of human neuroanatomy. Could you talk a little bit more about that, like what some of the leads are and what is the evidence directly for those connections? I know some of it has to do with just like correlation of timelines, right?
Right. Well, I mean, so there's a basic awareness that we've had for a long time that, you know, there is a broad general trend towards brain size increase over human evolution, with many exceptions and side branches and so forth that we're discovering now. But yeah, I mean, our brains are bigger than any of the brains were 2 million years ago. So, and there is a trend there. Also, you know, the tools over time, with many exceptions and places where it didn't happen and so forth, but the most elaborate and sophisticated tools around 100,000 years ago were much more complex than the most elaborate and sophisticated tools that were around 2 million years ago. So there's a trend there, and there's two trends side by side, and, you know, I think maybe they're related to each other. Now, exactly how they're related to each other is a more difficult question. You know, did the brain get bigger and for other reasons that then spill over into being able to make tools? Or were the tools really important so that, like, if you could make a – if you're a little bit faster at making a tool, more reliable at making a tool, you had a little bit of a reproductive advantage, then, you know, then maybe the tools drove it. And those are hard to discern exactly. So that's why we try to do some of these experiments where we relate the actual process of making tools. We try to figure out, well, what does it demand cognitively, neurally? If there were pressure on being able to make these tools, these are the things then that would respond to it. So that's – we're just trying to sketch out some of the basics still at this point, I think, to make that link.
And to do that, you've done some research with neuroimaging and how that relates to thinking about tools, to making tools. Could you tell us some more about that?
Yeah. So we've done a couple different things. One is what most people are probably more familiar with, which is functional neuroimaging, which typically works somehow related to blood flow in the brain, responses of neurons when they're active. And so we can isolate those areas of the brain that are more active when you make a particular kind of tool. You know, for instance, the hand axes that I was talking about versus the earlier, simpler, older one style tools. And we can say, oh, well, this is the neural system related to these forms of cognition that is required to do that. So if there was something that changed in the past associated with this technology, it's most likely to be those systems. Then the other thing that we do is actually structural stuff. And that comes in two flavors. Also, you can look at plastic changes in the brain that are caused by a behavior. And this is something that in the past, I guess about 20 years or so, people really become aware that even over short periods, doing things like learning to juggle actually changes the physical structure of your brain, especially things like white matter, the sort of the cables that connect things in your brain. And so we've applied that also to stone tool making and seen that training to make hand axes, for instance, will increase certain white matter pathways in the brain. Interestingly enough, these are also white matter pathways that are larger in modern humans versus chimpanzees. So we know that it's something that has evolved in our history, and we can relate it to a behavior that also is observable to have come along at a certain time in our history. So we started to strengthen those sorts of inferential, well, maybe these things are related to the evolution of that pathway. The other thing that we can do that we're really just starting to look at is individual differences in structure and function of people. So if you get a large enough sample, there are small differences, for instance, in the rapidity with which people learn different kinds of stone tool making. You know, and you can then correlate with starting differences in their brain structure or the way that their brain changes over time. And I think that's really exciting because we can then also relate that to cognitive tests. So, you know, some of the initial stuff that we're getting is, you know, so if you're particularly good at planning, for instance, there's a task called the Tower of London, which you move sort of rings around on three pegs and you have to do it in a particular order. If you're good at that, you learn stone tool making faster. Slightly. yeah, I think that's really, really fast because we're actually making these links between particular cognitive operations and types of stone tool making that we can see in the archaeological record.
Now the test subjects who learned how to make stone tools and then you saw the changes in the brain, were any of them engaged in any activity that was comparable to stone tool use or construction, like carpentry or anything prior?
So we actually have data on that that we haven't analyzed yet. We have people write about their other hobbies and activities, and actually we've got a big pile of stuff we've still got to go through on that study. But, you know, sort of anecdotally, I do know that there were people from a bunch of different kinds of professions. Like, we had teachers. We did have one sculptor in the project. And so there, we don't yet have any hard conclusions about that because we need to work with the data. But one general impression I got that was a little bit counterintuitive is that if you have more experience with some of these things that you might think of as being, you know, conducive to knowing how to make stone tools, it can actually interfere if you're sort of set in your ways. But there's a lot more to be done with that. And one of the things that that bothers me is we always do these studies, you know, with the typical college undergraduates. And they're not generally known for being particularly good with their hands. So I would really like to expand into different populations and different ages. And but, you know. We're just getting started.
Okay. Yeah, because that's where you would find individuals who were, say, skilled craftsmen, craftspeople in other in other areas, right?
Yeah. And just people that are more commonly doing work with their hands. I work with people out when we go do excavations in Ethiopia and the Afar. There's their pastoralists. So they have herds of animals, and they make little walls out of stone all the time. And I mean, they're a lot more handy. They might pick it up a lot faster.
So obviously, getting the population you want is one experimental challenge. I would imagine another one if you're trying to do neuroimaging while people are engaging in tool making, don't you have to hold still, say, for fMRI?
Yes, for fMRI you do. So there is, you know, a couple kinds of workarounds. One of them is the earliest studies that we did, you know, about 18 years ago or more now. We used a technique called FDG PET. And positron emission tomography is something they don't use a lot for research anymore on kind of brain activation. But one of the things that it lets you do is we injected a radiological tracer into their bloodstream. And this is a glucose analog. And so it's taken up by basically hungry cells in the body. Like, they think it's glucose. It happens in the brain and neurons. And then it emits radiation. Small amounts, but this can be detected by, you know, a sensor array around the head. So basically, you can give somebody this injection, have them do anything you want, really. Like, they could run around the block, but we have them sit in a chair and make stone tools in an unconstrained way. Then you walk them over to the scanner about half an hour later, after they've been doing this for half an hour, and you collect an image of where the glucose built up. So this is great because you can do it and have them do real tasks outside the scanner, but it's limited because, you know, you've got time averaged over half an hour, and you can only do a couple of different conditions because it does involve radiation exposure, and you don't want to give anybody too much. The fMRI you mentioned, you have to be still, but we can take advantage of the fact that this is a little theoretical, but neuroscientists have largely converged on the idea that one of the ways we understand what we see other people do is to internally simulate it ourselves, in fact, using the same neural systems. And this is probably an important way that we learn from others as well, which is an important research question too. But we can take advantage of that, and we show people films of toolmaking in the scanner. And so this is most directly relevant to observational understanding and learning from other individuals. But it does pretty much use overlapping systems with execution, and we've shown that. So that's another sort of workaround. And a colleague of mine, Shelby Putt, is using something called functional near-infrared spectrography. FNIRS, anyway, is what I remember. And that actually uses near-infrared visible light that can penetrate the cranium and get some information on blood flow from superficial areas of the brain. And that you can wear while you're doing something as well. So there's a few workarounds that you can do to actually use neuroimaging techniques.
Now, I wonder, I don't know if anybody's looked at this, but would there be differences in the brain between doing a task and stone tool creation and simply imagining the task? Because of all, you know, we've looked at on the show a bunch of times about simply imagining doing something is very similar in the brain to actually doing it.
Yeah. So it's similar in very interesting and important ways, but also different in important ways, and particularly in the context of stone tool making, where some of the things that we're interested in are the actual skill to really deliver the right amount of force to the right place. We want to actually tap into that somehow. We did do an experiment, though, in which we were more interested in the kind of planning aspects and the evaluation aspects. And we had just people looking at stone tools and answering questions about what would be the good thing to do next, which is basically asking them to mentally imagine and simulate the actions. And you tap into different aspects of the task demands there. So we can use both, but there are aspects of stone tool making that are very reliant, I think, on actually doing it.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, but we're going to jump right back in with our interview.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
All right, we're back. Just recently, I happened to be reading a couple of papers in I think Frontiers in Psychology, I believe, about the possible role of tool use in the development of consciousness. The idea under this new framework was that maybe consciousness has something to do with creating states of objectivity in the mind, where you can sort of like imagine and correctly judge the properties of an object that is not yourself. I don't know if you've read
Is that Matt Rosano?
No, this was I'm sorry, I can't remember the guy's name, but he's from Europe somewhere. I think he might have been Maastricht.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know that. But yeah, I mean, there are potential links between consciousness. This is great for me, actually, because I told you how I, you know, got into this. I thought I wanted to be a philosopher and all this.
Right.
I'd love to get around to consciousness. They say, you know, wait till after you have tenure, maybe wait a bit longer than that. you know, wait till you're all done. But I do think there is a potential that there might be some way we could gain insight there. You know, if you think about what are the things that actually require consciousness, mm-hmm. like what is consciousness actually good for? And, you know, some people have said basically nothing.
Right. Epiphenomenalism.
You know, yeah. But if there is something that it's good for, it's for tasks that require attention. I mean, that's what consciousness is. It's attending to things, really getting the whole brain on board, you know, and focusing on this one thing. And I think that learning a skill like stone tool making is the kind of thing that demands that concentrated attention. And if consciousness is the way that you get that, if consciousness is the feeling that you have when you fully attend to things, then maybe there is a relationship there. I mean, some of the other things people, you can, as you know, you can get into a car and start thinking about something else and drive to work when you meant to go to the store and so forth, which is, you know, this sort of zombie stuff is pretty scary, actually, the things that you mm-hmm. can do without being aware of it. But things people can't do are sort of sustain, hopefully, conversations like what we're having here, you know, to stay focused, very skilled activities. I mean, if you were like a race car driver, you wouldn't drift away and think about something else. It demands your attention, demands consciousness. So I think when we pick up tasks in the past that required people to really focus and attend, we might be picking up things that are diagnostic of the need for conscious states.
Of course, one of the interesting things about tasks like that, like work with your hands, is that it requires a lot of consciousness when it's new to you and over time requires less and less.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, unfortunately, we really have to focus on studying people who are learning. Rather than, you know, expert performance is still interesting in many ways. But if you want to get at the real demands for something like conscious attention, that's going to happen when you're figuring it out. Later on, you know, I mentioned this to some of these people that can make a hand axe really well in like, you know, 12 minutes. They don't have to think about it at all. Someone like me, I have to attend to it so much that what always happens is I give demonstrations of napping, and then I will always wind up cutting myself because I'm trying to talk about it and do this, you know, and you're not focusing on it. So the more skilled you get, the more you can ignore the low level stuff and think about something else, you know, like making it a really appealing hand axe versus just trying to get something that you can use.
Do you happen to find that the most beautiful hand axes are also the best, like the most functionally useful, or are those things generally aligned or not aligned?
You'd be surprised the things that we don't know about stone tools because of the amount of time that it takes to do proper experimentation and actually test these sorts of things. So that's something that people are interested in, but there's only been a handful of experiments that actually looked at, you know, is the symmetry of the hand axe make it a more or less effective butchery tool? Does the straightness of the edge matter? Do any of the things, do the thinness of it matter? And to the extent that it's been shown, like the things like symmetry don't seem to really matter very much for the function. The evenness of the edge does seem to be important, and that might be aesthetic for some people. The sort of extreme thinning of the hand axes that we find very appealing, I think because it's hard to do, is something that, you know, maybe somewhat beneficial because the tool you're carrying around is lighter. But thus far, there's not a lot of evidence that things we think of as really aesthetically important about hand axes are particularly functionally important.
So this is another question we may not know the answer to. But do you think in general, is it more widely assumed that people in the, prehistoric times would make a hand axe and that would be their hand axe and they carry it around with them? Or is it something that would be made on site when it was needed?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to for archaeologists and for everybody to remember when we think about the past that this is a huge amount of time over a large area, you know, and they probably did just about everything at one time or another. At some sites where you're sitting close to raw materials, you know, like there's a site of Box Grove, it's pretty close to these chalk cliffs where the flint is coming right out. They seem to have used them lightly and discarded them, probably made them pretty close to the time that they were going to use them and that sort of thing. Elsewhere, they may have actually carried them around for when you don't have as much rock, you know, and you're going far from the source. You probably take the hand axe with you, and when it gets dull, you resharpen it and all these sorts of things. Maybe you keep using it till you've whittled it down the way we do a pencil nub, you know. So this is an area people try to understand basically the economics. This is sort of an economic question, you know, when does it make sense to just toss the hand axe versus, you know, carrying it with you and resharpening it? And it seems to be driven by the things you would expect it to be driven by, like distances from raw materials and the kind of activities that you're doing.
So you probably get asked this question a lot, especially this year since it's such a milestone year for the film. But we recently talked about the 2001 A Space Odyssey on the show. What are your thoughts about 2001 A Space Odyssey specifically? Of course, these scenes of ancient creatures engaging in tool use for the first time.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you may be aware that 2001 was actually produced in consultation with archaeologists and paleoanthropologists. So it was informed by current speculations, hypotheses about the origins of technology at the time. I think that we have a different view now. I think if you would ask most archaeologists about the origins of tool use and technology, they get very excited about things like cooperation and collaboration as being a real turning point for humans. And we are a very cooperative species, and this makes a lot of things possible. Whereas that vision was much more about the importance of killing each other and the sort of, you know, the killer ape, basically. And if you want to take a step back from that, there's a lot of my other colleagues in anthropology and other disciplines who might point out that these things are heavily influenced by our own social views at the time about what's important, because some of it is, you know, myth-making about human origins and what we think human nature is. And after World War II, it seemed pretty obvious we were all about killing each other. Right now, we'd like to think it's about cooperation. I don't want to get too heavy on that, because there actually is empirical arguments that can be made about this, in particular, looking at comparisons across species and the importance of cooperation versus competition in different contexts. So there is a framework for doing this, but it is interesting to think about our biases. But certainly, 2001, fantastic film. I wish the introductory segment were a little bit quicker, because I like to use it in my classes, but we have to sit there for like half an hour, and my students aren't up for it. I think it's they did their best to work with the current understanding at the time. It's a great movie.
This is another realm where we might ask you to speculate if you're comfortable. But one of the things we talked about with 2001 was the idea that, you know, so when the ape-like creatures first encounter the monolith in the savannah, they are changed in some way. But it's often assumed that maybe this is some alien technology that goes in and changes something in their brain. But an interpretation we talked about in the episode is one that's actually not what happens. That what happens is they see this object in their environment that is nothing like the rest of their environment. It looks completely artificial. And that simply seeing that spurred something in their imagination that allowed them to take up the tools. That makes me wonder about what would you imagine could be the role of simply seeing things in the environment to inspire the taking up and creation of tools?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably very important. I think this is the kind of thing that archaeologists are loath to actually talk about, because you're talking about, like, individual acts of invention that happened in the past, whereas the sort of the record that we have is this really, really high level averaged sort of thing. So it's hard for us. I mean, but clearly, you know, we shouldn't forget that these things are inventions. They're not like mutations or just inevitable things that happen. Like, somebody at some point had a new idea and did it. And then whether they were inspired by particular things in their environment, we like to think about, well, what were the kinds of things that they commonly encountered? And we could have some leverage to talk about that. You know, if they moved into a bit of a foraging niche, then they may be around these animal bones, you know, if there are stones available. If they cracked nuts occasionally, as chimpanzees do, you're going to accidentally fracture the rock and you know, you could imagine an aha moment there. But those are the things that are very difficult to actually get to. What I will say about the vision in 2001 is that it is an idea of a transformative moment. And this is something that was also very current and maybe is to a certain extent, the idea that the invention of the earliest stone tools should be some kind of transformative great leap forward that, you know, that changed everything. And that doesn't seem to be the case, actually. I mean, we now have one site at 3.3 million where they made stone tools. The next one is at 2.6 million. With nothing in between. Oh. Now, we're going to find eventually something, but it's not a lot. It didn't, like, take off and go crazy. And even at the 2.6, there's just a few, and it's not around two million years ago that they start doing this regularly in a lot of places. So there's this huge, long period of time where they're like, yeah, stone tools, maybe you could do it sometimes. When it's worth it, I don't know. And so it wasn't like this sort of, you know, gun that went off and everything changed, which is a different perspective than what we used to have.
Well, it makes me think about even today in modern society, you know, you have a new business that has a new type of product and it's always losing money at first, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It makes me wonder if, yeah, were these things more trouble than they were worth to begin with? And how, if that's the case, how would you get through that? You know, how would you trust it to keep making them?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I think, you know, my favorite sort of pet hypothesis right now is that, yeah, it was just too hard. In particular, the investment in learning how to do this, they did. Those were smaller brained individuals. They didn't have the same learning capacities that we have. And for whatever at the time, I think there was too steep a cost. I mean, occasionally it seemed worth it, but only a few individuals would learn. And then they had to spend so much time figuring it out that, you know, didn't really give them that much of an advantage. And then it was just lost in a small population and nobody did it for however long, you know. But you go on long enough and there may have been some selection either on the tool making or on other things that they were doing. It eventually lowered the costs for them a little bit. It wasn't quite such a stretch to be able to do this. And that's where you have the chance of it actually paying for itself, and then it would take off. So that's currently – because when it does take off around 2 million years ago, it's very close in time to the appearance of Homo erectus, which has a larger brain and body. So, you know, coincidence. But they messed around for a long time until something changed about the cost-benefit equation, I think.
Yeah. So many tantalizing mysteries.
I know. Yeah. I'm just imagining these sort of mini dark ages in their learning, huh?
Yeah, I mean, if you think of these small groups, very isolated, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, somebody could have a great idea and then, you know, they have a bad year and everybody dies and nobody thinks of it again for 500,000 years.
Wow. I'm sorry we keep asking you to speculate about stuff.
Yeah, it's fun.
These are the kind of questions we love to ask. But yeah, I mean, obviously – people should understand that there are tons of limitations on what we can know empirically about things this far in the past. So besides what we've talked about so far, what else do you find most fascinating about studying Stone Age technology? Like what really gets your gears going about it?
I mean, I guess one thing, maybe it's a bit technical, but we started to talk about the relationship between stone tool making and language, and one of the ideas that we discussed is that it created selective pressures, a benefit for being able to communicate better, which eventually led to language. But there's another idea that that there's a more direct connection between toolmaking and language because they might depend upon some of the same cognitive and neural systems, right? So this is an old idea, you know, relating to the idea that there's kind of a syntax of action, that the way we structure sequential actions is similar to the way we structure words in a sentence. In fact, words in a sentence are sequential actions. So there's clearly some really important differences, but there's also the possibility that some of the systems that we use just to put together complex sequences of actions in tool making are also important to language evolution, so that if you had selection acting on tool making, it would provide a foundation from which then you could get language evolution. And, you know, some of the work that we've done generally supports that idea that there is overlap, particularly in what people call Broca's area of the inferior frontal gyrus, which is related to language processing, but also to putting together complex actions of other kinds. And so currently what we're working on is actually putting people in the scanner, showing them videos of tool making, have them listen to language. We use computational methods to parse the structure of the language and the structure of the tool making, and we see if the kind of the syntactic structure that we see in the tool making and in the language produces the same responses in the brain. And that's not done yet, but so far we have some encouraging results along those lines. So this idea that basic action sequencing and statistical learning that you would have for putting together complex actions provided the foundation for language evolution is something that I'd like to continue pursuing.
That's fascinating. I mean, if you just think about your experience, there are ways that putting together a sentence can sometimes feel somewhat analogous to step-by-step activities with the hands, like the way that, you know, if you're used to speaking or if you're used to doing an activity, it can happen like we were talking about, mostly unconsciously. But then there are those moments where you feel you're maybe ready to break the sentence or something and you slow down and it becomes more conscious. Anyway, that's just what made – that made me think of.
Yeah, very much so. Morten Christensen is another colleague of mine that's written a bit about the concept of language as a skill. And you think about it, I try not to think about it while I'm speaking, and that's the point.
Right.
Because if you're attending to exactly how you're enunciating the words and so forth, you lose the thread of what you're trying to say. So you need to be able to very rapidly translate sort of a high-level intention into very particular motor actions. And then when you talk to me, I have to very rapidly translate what you're saying into sort of a loose summary. I mean, I can't remember exactly what you said 5 minutes ago, but hopefully I have a general idea of what we've been talking about. And so this is skill. It's just like when you a famous example is, you know, skiing down a mountain slope. I mean, initially, if you don't know what you're doing, you're focused on how you're positioning your feet and so forth. Later on, you can ignore that and focus on, you know, skiing the slope. And so your focus of attention moves. And it's the same in language and tool making. And I think the neural systems are related to each other.
Yeah, it's kind of like how if you I think there are actually even studies of this, that if you focus too consciously on, say, like shooting a basketball, you get worse at it.
Yeah, exactly. You experience the flow. You have to automate a lot of it. Yeah.
Well, Dietrich, this has been so great. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
All right. So we hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dietrich Stout. I know Robert and I did. So if you want to follow up and check out any of the centers we mentioned, like the Center for Mind, Brain, and Culture, that's cmbc.emory.edu. But you can also we'll put a link to that on the landing page for this podcast. You can also check out the Paleolithic Technology Laboratory site at scholarblogs.emory.edu/stoutlab. And then there was one more thing that Dietrich emailed me about. So he talked in the interview about the role of sound in tool making. And so he sent me actually a link to a study where you can be a participant in trying to – it's a study where they ask you about your experience with certain types of, you know, like playing a musical instrument or something like that. And then you get to listen to different stone napping sounds and estimate the size of the chip that was produced by the sound you're listening to.
Oh, nice.
Or I guess not produced by the sound, but that the sound was correlated with.
And we'll make sure the link for that is on the landing page as well. And the landing page for this episode, you will find it at stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's our mothership. That's where we have all the episodes. That's where we have links out to our various social media accounts. That's where we have our tab for our store, where you can purchase some merchandise with our logo or something related to a particular episode. It's a great way to support our show. But if you want to support our show in a way that doesn't cost you a single dime, just rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so. We're talking Apple Podcasts or even our Facebook page. You can rate us there. People have been giving us some nice ratings there, and all of it helps the all-powerful algorithm that rules our lives.
Big thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback about this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, let us know where you listen from, how you found out about the show, stuff like that, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.